Michelle. So welcome back, everybody. Excited for part two of our David and Bathsheba series as we try to unravel one of the most mysterious and also most important stories in all of Tanakh. I think the plan is going to be this week and next week we'll discuss David's sins in depth. And then hopefully after that, we'll be ready to move on to discuss the response. How exactly do we have the redemption? We saw last week, yes, the main point of last week was the methodological introduction and the basic perspective we're going to have as we attack this whole story, which is to understand that on the one hand, the pshat is there and it's there for a reason. The pshat of the story convicts David of sins which are severe. At the same time, we ask the obvious question, which is how can we possibly reconcile this with everything we know about David and everything we know that the story itself tells us? I mean, the story itself has David somehow being redeemed at the end with Eshet Uriah becoming Eshet David and the child of David and Bathsheba being Shlomo, who is a friend of God and inherits the throne. So somehow, some way, this story ends happily to some degree. So, you know, if we read everything only at face value, that's almost impossible to understand how that can be the case. So the basic approach that we saw Rav Meidan present, and we've seen Chazal begin, and we're really going to get into it now, is to understand that on the one hand, Chazal, the Navi is not writing history, the Navi is writing ethically. And we need to focus on the ethical message that the pshat of the story is getting across, while at the same time being aware that what actually happened may not be exactly as we think when we first look at the psukim. We saw a couple of examples of that elsewhere in Tanakh, including once in Sefer Shmuel. His whole point is that the Navi is interested in the messages for us to learn. At the same time, you know, technical excuses and rationalizations can be important halachically, but they're not very important ethically. So, you know, for whatever, you know, for example, and we'll talk tonight about whether the question of adultery, did David and Bathsheba commit adultery? Was she married woman? And how can David and Bathsheba possibly marry halachically? We have the halacha of Isser Leba'al, Isser Leboel. You're not allowed to marry somebody who you committed adultery with. So, you know, the technical fact of what happened is going to be very important, but that's not what the Navi is interested in. The Navi is not interested in the details of Isser Leba'al, Isser Leboel. That you have to go to the Gemara and Ksubos, which we'll look at tonight. Now, the Navi is interested in the basic ethical message. What is happening here with a king and his subjects who he's taking advantage of? Okay, so let's load up the screen share. We'll go through the source sheet together for tonight's sheet. Okay, part two, the crimes before the cover-up. So let's launch into the beginning of the parak. And we have a couple of psukim which seem pretty innocuous. But the Malbim makes a critical point that actually this is setting the table for everything which is going to go downhill from here. You know, it's interesting. Like, there are so much time is spent trying to explain away David's Averos in this Perek. The Malbim actually begins the Perek by saying, well, if we look at the Pesukim carefully, we can find a sin which the Navi does not put a major spotlight on. But take a look. The Navi tells us that at the beginning of the year, it's the time when the kings are going out to war. So the rainy season is over. It's not yet time when it's miserably hot in Eretz Yisrael. You have that nice window of time, you know, March, April, May, the springtime, when it's the great time to go to war. All the kings are going out to war. David sends out Yoav, he sends his servants, which means the professional army, and he sends all of Israel. The entire army is sent out by Yeshchisu, Hispanei Ammon. They're destroying Ammon. It's all wonderful. We're continuing David's string of victories. Vayatsur al Rabbah, they besiege Rabbah, the capital city of Ammon. The David Yoshev Yerushalayim, David dwells in Yerushalayim. And then it's the next pasuk, which says, there's an evening time. Vayakam David Rial Mishkavo, David gets out of bed. Apparently, David was in bed during the afternoon. He was taking a nap. There's never a good nap by a king in Tanakh. Every nap ends with disaster. So he gets up. He goes to the roof. He sees a woman bathing. Leisha Tovas Marama Ode, the woman was exceptionally beautiful, and we know where that is going to lead to. That seems like it is just the introduction to the story, and you can skip it over, and then, okay, let's get to what's happening. Let's get to Bathsheba. Let's get to Uriah. Let's get to the battles and the politics and the sins and the Navi and everything that's super exciting. The Malbim tells us, no, we need to slam on the brakes. So why does the Navi have such an introduction here? It says, there is a theme which the first couple of psukim are pounding out, and we really need to blow this up. Writes the Malbim, says, hold on a second. Al yedei sheyashav hamalach beveito. The king is sitting at home. Since David was sitting at home and he did not go out to fight the wars of God, that is what causes this whole thing to happen. The Malbim says, how does David get to this in the first place? Right? We're going to talk about the corruptive power of the kingship, the irresistible Yetzer Hara that the power and privileges being king can provide, and how thoroughly they can corrupt somebody, even of David's ethical stature. So writes the Malbim, what unlocks all of that, what gets the ball moving, is the fact that David stays in Jerusalem. And there's point after point to drive this home. And then we need to dig deeper and understand what is the meaning of that. Why is it so important for us to know that David stayed home? Well, says the Malbim, let's see. First of all, he's staying home. Second of all, the Navi is telling us it's the time when everybody's leaving. Everyone's going out to war. And yet David sends Yoav instead, right? Yoav goes, the professional soldiers go, all of Israel goes. There's only one person, one man, the implication is, who stays in Yerushalayim, and that is David HaMelech. David Yoshev B'Yerushalayim. And then says the Malbim, it gets even worse, because it wouldn't be the end of the world for David to stay home. David maybe is involved. He's busy on the home front, right? The king has both foreign policy requirements and domestic policy requirements. So maybe David is involved in Tzedek and Mishpat. Maybe he's involved in some important affairs domestically. No, he's at home. He's taking a nap. He's taking a walk on the roof. The whole image we're given of David at the beginning of the parak is a king who is taking it easy, who is taking a break, who is totally luxuriating. Now, on the one hand, frankly, David deserves a vacation. I mean, David's been fighting and running basically nonstop from when we first met him. I mean, he fights Goliath, and then he instantly becomes Shaul's general, and then he instantly becomes Shaul's most wanted man in the kingdom, and then he's running around fighting basically nonstop until now. So we can understand the desire for David to take, you know, a couple of weeks in Wisconsin. But you can't do that when you're the king and you're sending everyone else to war and you're standing back, right? All of a sudden, that enjoying David allowing himself for the first time, really, to enjoy the privileges of kingship, as opposed to just focusing himself on the responsibilities, once he opens that door a crack, it is going to blow open rapidly. We should also note, and this is going to be a theme we're going to develop as we go through everything that David does wrong, that David's sins are going to corrupt himself. Everything that David does wrong, it's not just going to be some avera. We're particularly going to see things David does which destroy or stand up diametrically opposed to core values that David represented before he became the big fancy king in Jerusalem. We're going to have like five or six of these examples as we proceed. And the first one is already presented here in these first couple of psukim with the insight of the Malbim. Because how did David first burst onto the scene? When Goliath faces off against Shaul's army, and Goliath told them, you know, why does someone should fight me? Choose a man, and then have that man come down to me. Writes Rashi, and it's obvious, who is the man who Golias is not so subtly hinting should come to fight Golias? Well, it should be the leader of the Jews. It should be the tallest, strongest, best armed member of the army. And that is Shaul HaMelech. Shaul should be the obvious candidate to go and fight Golias. I mean, he was introduced as the tallest member of Kal Yisrael. Shaul does not go. He shirks his responsibilities as king. David is the only man who goes, right? All the entire Jewish army in the Golias battle stayed back. David was the only person who goes up to the front to take on the challenge. And now that David has become king, we have the exact opposite scenario. All of Israel is out fighting in the battle, and David, the Navi, presents it as if he's the only man on the home front, right? So it's not only, as the Malbim points out, that he is taking a break to enjoy the privileges of being king. And then we see he's home, he's luxuriating, he's napping, he's hanging out on the rooftop. It's also an undermining. Young David, the shepherd, in the camp facing off against Goliath, never would have recognized this David who is at home during the battle. And there's one more point which very strongly compounds the diuk of the Malbim. This parak, parak yud aleph, and the previous parak, parak yud, both prakim have one word which is used more frequently than any other word in the whole parak. And that is the word of shalach, to send. The previous chapter was the chapter of David's and Yoav and Avishai's titanic victory over the Eastern Alliance of Aram up in Syria and Ammon in modern day Jordan. And then Parak Yud Aleph is a parak of Hashem and Uriah. Now, in that parak, everybody was sending people. David sends ambassadors. David sends generals. Ammon sends mercenaries. Then David's the enemy king sends his own general. It was all sending and sending and sending. All the kings are doing this. All kings are very, very important. Kings don't do things themselves. King sends their servants and they send their diplomats and they send their generals. They don't get directly involved. The word shalach is also used more frequently than the other word in this parak over here. Everybody's sending. David is going to send Yav to fight. David is going to send messengers to bring in Bathsheba. Bathsheba is going to send messengers to David. David's going to send messengers again to Yav. David's going to send Uriah. Uriah is going to send back. Yav's going to send back. Everyone's sending. It's no personal communication. The climax of the previous parak was after all of the kings were sending and sending and sending. I send my general, you send your general, you send your diplomat, I send my mercenary. The climax was in Pasuk Yud Zayin, when David is told that the enemy general is coming, because Hadadezer, the enemy king, sent his general. So it's told to David. Finally, Vayasof es kol Yisrael vayavor es hayardin. David himself unites and gathers all the people. David himself marches at the head of the army. And the victory was total. Right? Victory was complete. The whole climax of the last parak was to build up as everyone was sending. Finally, we see what a Jewish king does. Jewish king takes things into his own hands. He does not just, delegate responsibility to somebody else completely while he stays hanging out at home. You know, Hadadezer is probably getting drunk back in the palace. That's not what David does. David unites the people. That's what a Jewish king is supposed to do. And now, right after that whole thing happens, David completely goes 180 degrees. You know, if we could have like a bigger number than 180 degrees, the total opposite direction. All of a sudden, he has lapsed back into the way of the kings around him, staying at home and luxuriating in the palace while he just sends his generals to do his dirty work. And, you know, we've seen David previously at home engaged in Mishpat, but that's not happening here. He's just on straight vacation. And this recalls for us, and this focuses for us, I think, what we should be thinking about, what lens we're going to use as we go through the rest of the parak, realizing that what the parak is presenting us with at the beginning is not the David HaMelech that we've known until now. We're being presented with a king who is now realizing and enjoying the privileges and luxuries available to the kingship. and everything that's going to do. And this was exactly the warning that Shmuel Hanavi gave to Bnei Yisrael when they wanted a king. And it's worth just looking at it for 30 seconds. David Shmuel tells the people, what's talking about a king? He has one message. You want a king? The king is going to take and take and take and take. Yikach, yikach, yikach. He's going to take your sons. He's going to take your daughters. He's going to take your fields and your olives and your grain and your servants. Everything you have, the king is going to take. What do Bnei Yisrael say? Bnei Yisrael say no. And ironically, we want to be like everyone around us. We want to be like everyone else. We want to have a king who will judge us and go before us in battle. Now, the irony, and Bnei Yisrael are so idealistic over here. They think that what the kings around them do is spend all day long judging and leading the people in battle. That's not what the kings around Bnei Yisrael do. What the kings around Bnei Yisrael do, what the kings of Ammon and Aram and Moab do, they spend their whole time getting drunk in the palace. Ahasuerus is the model for the king in real life, not for the model that the Jews imagine. And so they want a king who is going to judge them and lead them in battles. But that's actually what a Jewish king is supposed to do. The irony is, in this parak, we're going to see Shmuel's warning come to fruition. They're going to get a king who now is going to behave like the kings all around them. He is going to take and take and take. He's going to use the kingship not for Shvatanu, not for judgment, not for Yetzal Lefaneinu, not for leading the people in war. He is going to use the kingship for the realist perspective that Shmuel had warned would happen, for taking and taking and taking. Right? And that's the first betrayal that David has. It's the first betrayal of himself, and it's going to lead to everything else. Okay, so now let's look at what happens next. Right now is where things, with that background, that perspective, that foundation that the Navi lays for us. So now we can look at the next three pesukim, which is a lot in three pesukim. So David is up on the rooftop after his nice nap, and he sees the beautiful woman bathing. So Vayishlach David Vayidrosh Leisha, he wants to inquire about the woman. Lidrosh, that's like a pretty aggressive and thorough questions that he's asking over here. Vayomer, it was said to him, or someone said, Halo zos bat sheva bas Eliam eshes uri achit. Apparently this is Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah. Uriah apparently is someone that David knows. I think the Malbim writes that David knows who that is. He may have even suspected. Oh, is that Bathsheba? I kind of recognized her from, you know, the last time there was a military reunion and all the generals and their wives were at the palace. She looks kind of familiar. Yeah, confirmed. This is not just some ordinary civilian. This is a particularly important person. Her husband is one of the leading commanders in David's army. The end of Sefer Shmuel gives the whole list of David's head commanders. Uriah is on. Then what happens? Apparently David is undeterred by the fact that this is a very prominent and important woman. He sends messengers to take her. Think of Shmuel talking about everything that the king is going to take. So the messengers take her. He comes to her. They sleep together. And then the Navi gives us a strange detail. She had just purified herself from impurity. She had just gone to the mikvah. Most of the Farshim understand that's why she's bathing. She's bathing because she's concluding her period of Nida, and now she's pure. We should just appreciate that this is, even though her husband is out at the battle, in the time of Tanakh, a woman would have to purify herself anyway because of the laws of Tuma and Tara, right? Because of just regular purity law. There's Truma, there's Karbanos, there's Kadshim. So as anybody who is Anida and finished that period is going to go to the mikvah. Bathsheba is no exception. But still, like, why do I need to know that? We'll see a couple of Mefarshim in a second. Bathsheba Beisa, she goes back home. Then Batarisha, she gets pregnant. Batashlach, Batagid, David, she sends. Right, another, everyone's sending. She sends and tells David, Batomer, Hara Anochi, I am pregnant. Those are the only two words that Bathsheba speaks in all of Sefer Shmuel. You don't see Bathsheba talk again until Sefer Melachim, when she has to make sure that Shlomo becomes king. So there are so many questions to ask, but let's just focus on two. Number one, a local question, and number two, a general question. The local question is, why does the Navi tell us that Bathsheba went to the mikvah? What does that add? And the broader question, this sounds like adultery. Is that indeed what is happening? And if that is what's happening, what do we learn from that? And if not, how? How can this be anything but straight adultery, which should lead to the prohibition of Isra the Baal, Isra the Boel, and there should be no way for David and Bathsheba to possibly marry afterwards, right? I think towards the end of the Shir series, we will look at the relationship between the story of David and Bathsheba and the story of Yehuda and Tamar, because they have a lot in common for good reason. But the story of Yehuda and Tamar, well, the upshot there was that Yehuda thought it was a forbidden relationship, but it turned out that it was a permissible one, because in the system, the way that they observed Yibam before the Torah was given was that he indeed was eligible to perform Yibam with his daughter-in-law. That's not the case here. There's nothing to allow David to marry Bathsheba afterwards, the way that Yehuda marries Tamar. So what on earth is going on? Right? Those are the two major questions to ask. So first, let's look at the local question, and that'll help set up the bigger one. Why are we talking about Mita? Abarbanel and Radak give two different approaches. Abarbanel, which makes sense because Abarbanel throughout the whole parak is inclined, he's great to have because you want somebody who is reading every pasuk at the pshat level, because you want someone to have that message for you of, here, right, here's the message that the Navi would give. Here is the straight read at every turn of every pasuk, which makes David look as bad as possible. Right, we want that to be there. What does Abarbanel do with this pasuk over here? And he says, tell you why we care that Bathsheba is a nida. Ravi Gidze Laudia, Sha'az Nis Abra Lios Hazman Haraui Yoserila. That's telling us that this was the most fertile time of the month. If there was any terrible day for David to have an affair with the married woman of one of his commanding officers, where it could lead to a child, which is going to cause him so many problems, it would be that night when he sees her emerging from the mikvah. So Abarbanel understands that this detail is put here to emphasize David's reckless behavior. He couldn't even wait 2 or 3 days. You see the power of the Yetzer Hara. He couldn't wait 2 or 3 days. He knew that this was the riskiest time to go ahead. He saw her coming out of the mikvah, but there's no stopping the Yetzer Hara. Bring her to the palace tonight. Whatever the consequences are the consequences, and I'll deal with them later. That's the mentality of Yetzer Hara. Think in the extreme short term, and I have to have this pleasure immediately. That's how the Abarbanel understands the message the pasuk is getting across. The Radak has another approach, which is funny, honestly, which is important because this story is dark, so we need some humor. But we have to ask, like, what does it mean? So first, Radak points out Uriah Hachiti. So is he a Hittite? So Radak says, yeah, he might be a ger. He might be a convert. He probably is a convert. David has many converts in his army. We'll come back to that idea later. Okay, the idea that Uriah is a ger. Then Radak says, why do we care that she just went to Mecca? So he writes, Leodia ki lo shachavi mavihi nida. Now he wants us to know that when David slept with Bathsheba, she wasn't a nida. She wasn't a nida. Don't have to worry about that. Baruch Hashem, she went to the mikvah. Skip one line, right? Let's pick up on the question. Lo avar elah misham nida. David did not violate nida, the chiv kares of nida, David didn't violate. Baruch Hashem, he made sure, he confirmed before he brought it to the palace, 100% guarantee there's no halachic problem of nida in this relationship. Ella misham eishasim. But the only problem is that she's a married woman. No nida, I made sure, I confirmed, The only small, minor, technical, halachic detail to worry about is, yeah, she's a married woman. Which doesn't make any sense. I mean, that's self-evidently absurd, right? It's a joke. It's a joke. Oh, Baruch, like, well, anyway, like someone, he commits murder, right? He commits murder in the middle of the street. And he says, well, Baruch Hashem, I waited until Tuesday. I didn't do it on Shabbos. Okay. I murdered the guy on Tuesday. So you don't have to worry about Shabbos. I only need to worry about murder. That's what the Navi is telling us. Like, you know, really? So that sets up what the Radak brings in next. And I think this is why the Radak reads the pasuk this way, because he thinks that it is a hint to the next line. It does not make any sense for David to be scrupulous about Hilchos Nida and yet not really care about Hilchos Eshes Ish. So the Radak immediately says, Rabbeinu Zal Amri, Kol Hayotze L'machames Beis David, Ketrisos Kasav L'Ishto, any soldier who went out to one of David's wars, it's the first time that Bnei Yisrael are fighting consistently in faraway lands. So to avoid issues of aguna, they would write a get to their wives. It's been a practice for Jewish soldiers for centuries and centuries. The Gemara tells us that it's been Jewish practice for millennia, going back to David HaMelech. He says, great, that's why there was no issue over here. Apparently, technically, this may not be adultery. He says, Lefichach Savav David Esmi says, Uriah Shti Mugreshes Lefreya, David arranged things to get Uriah killed so that she'd be divorced retroactively. It's really problematic, because then why does he send Uriah back to Bathsheba? But we'll talk about that later. But I think what we might get from this Radak is, if the Pasuk indeed is flagging that she wasn't a Nida, so hint, hint, one way to read the Pasuk is hint, hint, if we care so much that she's not a Nida, hint, hint, she might not be a married woman either. Right? You don't care about Nida if she's a married woman. So that could be what the a very subtle point in the text to indicate that what's happening here is not quite as bad as first meets the eye, only almost as bad, right? Now that segues us into the bigger question at hand, which is what was happening with David and Bathsheba? What exactly was the nature of this relationship? And why could it possibly halachically continue going forward? So we're going to see three approaches to explain why David and Bathsheba could possibly get married afterwards. Because this is the central contradiction, right? We know fact at the end of the story, somehow they're going to be allowed to be together. So this is the central issue that has to be dealt with. Two suggestions from Chazal, which we have to discuss each one. One suggestion, which I think is very interesting, from Rabbi Yaakov Meidan. So the Gemara in Ksuvos on Daf Tes asks this question, black on white, with Neima Lo Asura. Why wasn't Bathsheba prohibited to David? Now everybody likes to quote the second answer. Radak included. Rashi included, by the way. Quote second answer, there was a get. There was a secret off the record get. Now, it's a technical get. It's a very technical divorce. Technically, it's not adultery. The pasuk will present it as adultery because for all intents and purposes, that's what it is. And we care about the ethics. We don't care about the technical historical details. But technically, the second answer was that there was a get. You need to look at the details of that get. But that's not the first answer. First answer the Gemara gives is Hasam Onis Ha. First answer the Gemara gives is that the reason why Bathsheba was not prohibited to David was that this was, I want to use that word carefully over here, and I'll explain why in a minute, this was a coerced relationship. Bathsheba did not have a choice. And at least according to the Talmud Bavli, because the Talmud Yerushalmi does not agree with this perspective, but according to the Talmud Bavli, if the prohibition of adultery, right, to subsequently marry the paramour, only applies in cases of a consensual relationship. Which the conceptual basis for that probably is that, because like why should the paramour benefit because he did it coercively as opposed to consensually? It doesn't really make any sense. The reason probably is there's one iser, there's one prohibition of being with her husband after adultery and with the guy. But if she's not going to be prohibited to her husband, which makes sense in this case because we're saying that it was coerced. So once she is not prohibited to her husband, mamela automatically, technically, she will not be prohibited to the paramour either, because the two of them are a package deal. And if the husband remains permitted, then the other guy is going to remain permitted as well. That's the first answer of the Gemara. But we need to understand what exactly it means. I do not remember who wrote this. There was an article recently in Tablet. I think it quoted another article, which was talking about, it was in the aftermath, I think, of the Chaim Walder episode. And it was talking about, you know, how we teach these topics in schools. And the article said, you know, which totally fair, that we do not do a good job in our schools of teaching about the perspective on sexual violence. And the article said, imagine how differently, I think I quoted this Kumari, and said, imagine how differently a class would look like in two different scenarios. You have somebody who's teaching David and Bathsheba, and you have one version of the class where I'm pretty sure it was a Mora even in front of the classroom, quotes the second answer of the Gemara. There was a get, and we move on, right? So she writes, well, what would it look like if instead the Mora focused on the first answer, says that it was ones? This article translates that as rape and said, let us look at the story of David and Bathsheba from the perspective of Bathsheba as a victim of rape. Wouldn't that be a much better chinuch opportunity when approaching this story, right? You're leaving it on the field and an opportunity to talk about such an important topic. Now, the big problem with doing that, though, is that there's not really anything in the psukim that indicates that there was rape here. I'm deliberately changing from you know, the issue of whether she had a choice or not to rape. Rape, the Navi focuses on in all of its horrible detail in a couple of chapters. If we want to teach from that perspective, that is the story of Amnon and Tamar in Perek Yud Gimel, where the Navi puts it on full display. It's all there. There's nothing in the psukim that one could hold on to say what was the experience of Bathsheba here. And in fact, there are multiple indications that this was not rape. What the Gemara means here by ones, it's not rape, but the Gemara means is that at the end of the day, if Bathsheba wanted to say no, she would not have had a choice. Technically, this is ones. Technically, she didn't have a choice. But think about it. There are really three major points that indicate that this wasn't right. I'm going to scroll back up for one second. A couple of these points are of Meitan makes. I'm not sure if he makes this point, but the way the Navi describes what happens, they take her. Okay, that line, she didn't have a choice. She's coming with the messengers. But the Navi adds a couple of words. Vatavo ela, she came to him. Vayeshkavima. The Navi adds a couple of words which indicate that Bathsheba did have some active role. If we read the Pesukim very carefully, that line, Vatavo ela, does not sound like rape. Furthermore, if that is what happened, right? If it was just, you know, the king who's out of control and forces himself on Bathsheba totally against her will, asks Rav Meidan, why does Bathsheba send a letter to David saying, I am pregnant? That's not who she should send her message to. She should send her message to her husband saying, here's what happened, and now I am pregnant because I was assaulted by the king. We never see any interaction between Bathsheba and Uriah. And it seems like the rest of the parak is a cooperation and a cover-up between between Bathsheba and David. She's sending David a message. We have a problem here. How can we cover it up? If this was totally forced, then you would think that she should send a message to Uriah. And the last point, the point which is really the most convincing one, really, which is really, I don't know what there is to respond to that, is at the end of the story. So this child that David and Bathsheba have dies, which we're going to have to focus on. First of all, if it was rape, why should Bathsheba lose her child? If she did nothing wrong at all, why should she be punished with the loss of a child? And it's clear that she, not surprisingly, she takes this very hard, because the Navi tells us, "Vaynachim David es eis Bathsheba ishto." David comforts her. It was a horrible and traumatic loss for David, but also for Bathsheba. And David seems to successfully comfort her. If the way this story really began was with what we would call rape, then this pasuk would be very difficult to digest. Vaynachim David eis Bathsheba ishto. I mean, it's like almost unimaginable. What the Gemara means when it says Hasam Ones Haba, it means that at the end, and this really gets into the deeper message of the whole story, technically, Bathsheba didn't have a choice. She was okay with going. She was okay with going. She was a partner in the sin. There are multiple indications of that. That's going to be very important for understanding the rehabilitation, actually, because we'll have to understand David's mindset in the whole thing. But the fact that technically she could not have said no if she had wanted to, that is enough to technically render this a case of ones and technically render Bathsheba to be permissible to David after. So we're all in the realm of halachic technicality. And that's going to be the case with all of these explanations, where there is the technical situation and then there's the reality afterwards. And the prophet Nathan is going to come to David and he's going to say, how dare you take this woman to be your wife? The justification, the halachic justification, is a technical one. Now, we'll see what, David's going to have a reason to be able to do it, okay? But there is a technical explanation. The Navi's not interested. Now let's talk about the second answer, the answer of the get. So Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam argue as to what exactly this get was. Rashi says that the get was given on condition. The soldiers are going to war, and so they give their wives a conditional divorce. If I don't come back from the battle, then you're going to be considered divorced from the date that I was killed in action or the date that I was missing in action. Rabbeinu Tam disagrees, and Rabbeinu Tam says, no, it's a regular get. It's a regular get. And he says, according to Rashi, there's a problem. If the get was only given on condition, how could David sleep with Bathsheba? Why shouldn't David be afraid that Uriah would survive? After all, he's a very good soldier. He's a very good fighter. He's going to come back from the battle, and it will turn out that what David did was adultery. That's Rabbeinu Tam's question. According to the way Rashi reads this line, it was adultery. What's probably the answer? Rashi says, yeah, that's okay. The Gemara is, we understand we are not shielding David from violating adultery. Maybe technically at the end of the day, he didn't. Technically, halachic, it's not adultery. But in terms of in the moment, David's sin in the moment, yeah, she was Ashes-ish. She absolutely was. She absolutely was. Okay. And that, and we'll come back then one second. Third suggestion, Rav Meidan makes, as to, again, why it would be that technically speaking, David would be allowed to marry Bathsheba afterwards. And he goes back to the fact that it seems like Uriah was not born Jewish. He's Uriah Hachiti. Makes sense that he was a ger. He's one of the many gerim we find in Sefer Shmuel who have joined David's army. When you can't beat him, join him. And David has plenty of these people in his forces. Well, Gemara says, and the Rambam codifies, I brought the Rambam here just because it's easier to read, that those conversions were suspicious. Were people really converting in the time of David and Shlomo because they were like on fire for Yadus, or because it was a good time to become a Jew? Well, the Malbim writes, the Rambam writes, Al Yalal Daitcha Shimshon HaMashiach Yisrael, it should not occur to you that Shimshon who saved the Jews, Oh Shlomo Lach Yisrael Shnikri did Hashem, Shlomo was called God's friend, Nasu Nashim Nachrius Begeusan. Don't think that they married Gaia. Now, this happens to be the exact same methodological point we're focusing on, because the Psukim describe Shimshon's wives or women as Plishtim, and the Psukim describe Shlomo's wives as non-Jews. So the Rambam says, literally, that's not the case. Exactly the same scenario we're dealing with over here, right? The Navi presents them as Goyim. Technically, they were Jewish. What was the problem? During the time of David and Shlomo, when David is on is conquering everything, and in Shlomo's time, the economy is going bananas. So they realize that people are not converting to Judaism with genuine desire to do so. So the Batei Din are turning away converts. Converts are not allowed when we cannot verify, when we suspect that they're not converting to the right voters. But some people convert anyway. You had some non-centralized Batei Din, and you had sketchy Geiris. You had Geiris, which was not universally approved. And that is who Shlomo is marrying. That is who Shimshon is marrying. And that, Rambam says, or that Rav Medan suggests, is exactly what is happening with Uriah HaChiti over here. Writes the Rambam, Fisha Gir Shlomo Nashim Nasan, Bechain Shimshon Gir Benasa, Shlomo and Shimshon married women who converted. They knew why these people were converting. The Plishti woman is converting to marry Shimshon. These women who David are marrying, or Shlomo are marrying, they're converting because they want to be with the Jewish nation as it is skyrocketing. The law of Hibazdin Girum was not through the officially sanctioned Sanhedrin. Chashavan hakasov kigilu hein akum uvisuren omd. So the Navi presents them as if they were Goyim. Right? It's the exact same situation that we're dealing with over here. They're presented as X, because even though technically they're Y. So Redan suggests that maybe that could be what's happening here with Bathsheba and Uriah. Uriah's conversion could be questionable, right? So the Navi is going to present it as adultery because ethically it's adultery. He's converted, they're married, they're living as husband and wife. Now, once the Shaila comes up and you get into the details in the Shulchan Aruch, you say, turns out that maybe Uriah was not really halachically Jewish, and therefore he wasn't halachically married to Bathsheba, and therefore that would not trigger the prohibition of Isser Labael, and David would not be prevented from remarrying Bathsheba after the fact. But that's all technical. Now, according to this answer, and according to the Gemara's first answer, that this was coerced, and according to Rashi's understanding of the answer about the get, all three are agreeing that either literally or ethically, for all intents and purposes, David did indeed commit adultery. Maybe that can be answered technically, maybe not. Right? But that, and it's important to have the proper perspective on that. What is the perspective to have on that? It is the parallel Gemara in the Yerushalmi, which is dealing with the same issue as the Gemara in the Bavli in Tzuvos. Amra Bizira, Masnisa Amra, Afilu Sheirin Mizanin. Even the best of the best are not immune to the Yetzer Hara for Gilei Arayos. Titani, Afilu Chasid Sheba Chasidim, Ein Mimanin Oso Apotropos Al Ha Arayos. Even the most pious of the most pious cannot be appointed as an agent to prevent a guardian with Arayos, right? This line is also in the Bavli, Ein Apotropos al Arayos. Everyone is suspected. The Yerushalmi has the best layout. Filu Chasid Shebechasid. We should not think that people are perfect and that people are immune from the Yetzer Hara. And according to what the Gemara is laying out here, right, what most of the Mefarshim are laying out here as well, is that, yes, even someone of David's caliber, afilu chassid shebechassidim, do not think that they are immune from this possibility. And given the opportunities that are available to a king, and given David beginning to slip and indulge himself in the luxuries of being a king, look how quickly that can fall apart. In 4 or 5 psukim, David HaMelech can indeed fall into Eshesh. And the Gemara in Bava Metzia says this basically black on white. Gemara has a line, it is better for a person spiritually, Sheyavo al Safek Eshesh, to be with a possibly married woman. Gemara here seems to be assuming that there was that sketchy get. Not to embarrass somebody publicly. Basically, the Pasuk in Tehillim talks about people around David rejoicing as he's being crushed and being torn. What's the tearing and what's the celebrating? What's the laughing? Amazing line from the Gemara. If they tear me open, I wouldn't bleed. I've been so embarrassed and so humiliated. I am white, not just at my skin, but to my bones. They've drained my blood. I am thoroughly white. That's how embarrassing. We're in the Beis Medrash. We're learning Negaim and Aalos. It's a good discussion of Torah. Omrimli, David. Abba al Eshes Ish Misaso Bama. They ask me a shayla in the Beis Medrash. Ah, David. What's the punishment for somebody who commits adultery? I answer their question, right? He's executed by being strangled. However, but the Misa is machaper, he gets atonement, and then he gets olam haba afterwards. There is the crime of passion in the moment. There could be atonement for that. But you guys callously and coldly humiliating in public for afterwards, there's no chelak in olam haba. And the Gemara here is well aware of the potential for the sin of Yerayas, and it's taken extremely seriously, but don't think anyone is immune. Gemara says openly, yeah, we can say, possibly not, safek eshes ish, there are defenses, you want to learn a kvein atam, it's available, it's out there, but the Gemara and the Farshim are okay with reading the pasuk historically as this indeed having happened, right? And I think that's very important from the mindset of sin perspective. Don't think that anybody is immune to that. At the same time, that giving in the moment of passion, that normal universal Yetzer Hara, that in apotropos the Arayas Yetzer Hara, that initial pleasure caving which begins the story, that is not what David is going to be held so accountable for. What David is going to be held accountable for is what's going to happen afterwards. As we see, right? The Navi does not say anything about this to David. The Navi does not say boo about adultery when he blasts David in the next paragraph. What does he blame David for? He blames David not for the crime. He blames David for the cover-up, for the murder of Uriah, and then for remarrying Bathsheba afterwards to cover up what has just been committed in this paragraph over here. So next week, Marissa Hashem, we'll take a look at the cover-up, what the Navi says was the real problem over here. And I think we come out of this parent with this part of the Likud with a very important perspective. We still have multiple ways of evaluating David, but to understand the universal Yetzer Hara of Gilei Arayos, the Gemara is open to that Yetzer Hara. The parent can have Afilu Chassid Sheba Chassidim, and all of that coming from the initial slipping, right? The initial giving in to pleasure, once that mindset takes hold, there's no telling where it can go. And we'll see where it can go, the betrayal and the decay, which you're going to see next week, as David goes from the more, you know, standard, universal, understandable problems to the ones which are really going to get into trouble. So next week, we're going to focus on Uriah Chiti. Is this murder? Is he a rebel? Is this approved? What exactly happens in the battle, what's going on, and then we'll move on from there. So thanks, everyone, for coming. If anyone has any questions, love to hear. But otherwise, wish all a good night and have a great week. Looking forward to Mitzvah Hashem tomorrow learning next week.
Thank you.
Yashar Koach, thank you.